for a discussion of Yoda and all those other characters. It won't be that. I can assure you we have just as interesting characters. This will be a discussion of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or the ballistic missile defense system proposed by President Reagan and several others, and the controversies surrounding it. Holden this week has a tape, a videotape, on this. I've not seen the videotape, but we'll watch the videotape first, and then I'll go ahead and pick up on that. So we'll go with the videotape right now. We'll have a little high-tech over here. The some sort of ballistic missile defense system. There are other groups, of course, that are strongly opposed to it. So you'll, anytime you read the literature or see it, you have to realize that this is a very controversial topic.
Yeah, this is put out by a group called High Frontier, and it was a promotion piece that was put out before President Reagan made it official policy. It was by a group of people who wanted to promote the idea and get it so that it would be accepted as official policy. So it's something that shows the virtue of what their name for it is, the High Frontier.
The first is a global ballistic missile defense, a low Earth orbit network of space trucks, or carrier vehicles, that deploy clusters of small non-nuclear interceptors capable of neutralizing enemy ICBMs during the initial boost phase. A second level defense catches most of the missiles that get through the first layer. Finally, a ground-based point defense system is designed to enhance survivability of our existing Minuteman forces. Separately and together as an integrated system, each element of this defensive plan acts to increase U.S. ability to survive and respond to a Soviet first strike. They form a credible deterrent to Soviet military planners who may advocate a first strike policy. Let's examine each element of the High Frontier proposal. At the heart of the plan is a network of small space trucks or carrier vehicles in highly inclined 300-mile orbits. Each truck is capable of deploying numerous small heat-seeking interceptor missiles in an expanding sphere along its orbital track. Overlapping orbital tracks provide continuous coverage. Here is a possible intercept scenario. At launch, a Soviet ICBM rises almost vertically, then pitches over, more nearly following the Earth's curvature as it gains speed and altitude. Above the horizon, sensors can easily detect heat from the missile's exhaust against the cold background of space. Targeting computers select the appropriately positioned carrier satellite. Several interceptors are deployed and fan out as they accelerate along the orbital track. Sensors home in on the target exhaust. A conventional non-nuclear warhead disables the enemy missile during the first 7 minutes of its boost phase and prior to deployment of its multiple nuclear warheads. Much of the technology for such a system already exists. Given committed development resources, the system could be launched, deployed, and serviced by the space shuttle within 5 to 6 years, at a cost of approximately $15 billion, a fraction of our overall defense budget. The second level will incorporate the global ballistic missile defense and more advanced systems that may require further technological development. This level would offer the advantage of extremely rapid targeting after deployment of the enemy's multiple warhead payloads. It would be designed to disable targets above the atmosphere. Should any enemy warheads pass through the first and second defense zones, a third level of ground-based point defense installations will protect our Minuteman silos or other targets in the U.S. This defense system operates at short range with a very high-velocity salvo of small ballistic rockets. One such device, the Swarm Jet, is already under development. Swarm Jet, or other devices like it, could be deployed immediately and at relatively low cost. This would complicate an attacker's targeting problems and thereby enhance look at an engagement involving the entire system. The overlay shows the intercept coverage of a single truck as it passes over the Soviet Union on an orbit inclined 65 degrees to the equator. Other trucks, spaced 20 degrees apart along the orbital track, pass over the target region every 3 or 4 minutes. Still more carrier satellites on slightly different orbits provide blanket coverage over any desired region. When our reconnaissance systems verify a Soviet launch, U.S. interceptors are fired as Level 1 defense goes into action. Pinpoints and disables most remaining enemy targets above the atmosphere. Several warheads are entering the atmosphere on trajectories that would strike the Midwestern United States. At a U.S. Minuteman silo, fire control radar acquires the missile track and launches a swarm jet barrage at the incoming warhead, destroying it at a distance sufficient to protect our Minuteman, even if the attacking warhead detonates. It should be emphasized that no defense is perfect. Its purpose is to delay, deter, and make more difficult the attacker's position. A global ballistic missile defense and other systems described here can make the most of America's lead in space technology. The support system necessary to implement the military aspects of our spaceflight capabilities will also contribute greatly to such civilian programs as the Space Operations Center, Space Industry, and Solar Power Satellites. More importantly, this new national strategy represents a break from the dangerous policy of mutual assured destruction. What we propose is not a panacea. Space-based defense does not mean that our nuclear retaliatory capability can be abandoned or neglected. But by reducing the threat of an enemy first strike, we will have less compulsion to continue amassing ever larger arsenals of nuclear weapons. This will help to produce a more stable and peaceful world than we now inhabit.
Okay, let me go into, this was an early one. And the technology that's being proposed now is related to the Star Wars program. That's what the critics have called it, and it's kind of caught. The name is caught. Or the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, is somewhat different than proposed in here. There's a much greater emphasis being placed on lasers. Laser is a device. It's very much like when you take a magnifying glass and you focus the sun, and you get a concentrated beam of light, and you can burn a hole in a piece of paper. The idea is to concentrate the light of various different wavelengths so that you can burn a hole in the missile and blow up the missile or the warhead. That's the basic idea. Obviously, the technology is rather sophisticated. Let me go through just some of the fundamentals of this. If we draw the curvature of the Earth like this, what happens in a ballistic missile attack, a theoretical attack, because we haven't had any, hopefully we never will, is you start out with a boost phase. This is where the rocket is actually developing its acceleration. This is the phase you see of the rocket actually taking off. Most of the rocket never makes it over either into space or over, say, this is the Soviet Union and this is the United States. Most of the rocket never gets over here because, of course, you know, if you have something big and you accelerate it, it takes a lot more energy. So what they do is they have the rocket built in stages. Once they get the initial boost off, there's no point in carrying all the rest of that material along, so they drop that off and send off another stage. The actual warheads are a very small part of the total weight of the system. But what happens after the boost phase, after you've thrown it, the warheads behave very much like a slingshot, where there's like the rock in a slingshot, where now they're going on a trajectory. They're no longer powered, usually not, although there are some that might maneuver, but they're generally not powered. And what happens after the boost phase is that you will get many warheads coming because each rocket ever since about 1970, each rocket has multiple warheads. The MX missile will have about 10 warheads. Okay, so they will have 10 warheads per missile that will be coming over in here. Now that means that if you're going to go ahead and have a defensive system, you have to get the rocket in the boost phase. You have to really make a major effort in the boost phase, because you start out with one rocket with a large signal, that is the rocket engines going off, and then after the rocket boost phase is ended, you have all of these warheads. Not only do you have warheads, but you can have dummies. And this is space up in here. There's no air resistance, so a dummy will look just like a real warhead. One of the ways they might have the dummies, for example, is they will have the dummies be a balloon of some sort. And then they'll have the warheads in identical balloons. So you might have 10 warheads plus maybe 100 dummies that are going through space. And because there's no wind resistance up there, because you're out in space, the balloon will have the same trajectory as will the heavier or the more massive warhead out in space. And now in the real world, right down in here on Earth, of course, if you threw a balloon and you threw a bowling ball, the balloon would slow down because of the resistance. But if there's no air and you threw them, you started them at the same speed, the balloon and the bowling ball would go at the same speed. So it would be very difficult for you to detect which one they were. So you could have many, many dummies going up in here in addition to your warheads. And that would cause, of course, serious problems. So almost everyone agrees that what you have to do is you have to get this in the boost phase. They're proposing several ways of doing this. That was one of them, where they have orbiting satellites. The new systems they're proposing are orbiting satellites, which might have lasers, high-intensity energy, very concentrated, to fix on the booster and burn a hole in it. And the boosters, of course, are fairly fragile. And they can focus a light beam on that, intense light beam. It's not going to blow up just like that. It's not quite like in the movies. But if they can hold it on there for a short period of time, they could burn a hole in it. The problem is this rocket is going quite fast. You figure it takes 30 minutes to go from the Soviet Union to the United States. So you're going about, 8,000 miles? So that's about 16,000 miles an hour. You figure how many miles it moves in a few seconds, and you've got a very, very rapidly moving target. So one of the ways they want to do that is to have some satellites with lasers up here to be able to detect it. Well, if you have the satellites in a fairly low orbit, say several hundred miles, of course they're going around the Earth about 90 minutes. So you have to have a lot of satellites, because the only ones that you can use are the ones that happen to be over the Soviet Union when the booster goes up. So you have to have quite a few of them. And they're in this debate about how many you'd need. I won't get into that because I don't know that much about it, but there is a debate on how many satellites you'd actually want to use. There are several other ways that you might get the missiles in the boost phase. Edward Teller, who is the father of the hydrogen bomb, proposes that you launch over here, you launch another missile, and then you set off a device which is called an X-ray laser. And then you have to set it up because of the curvature of the Earth, and the X-ray laser would get the boost phase over in here. It's a laser, it's just X-rays have a very, very short wavelength, much shorter than the wavelength of the light we see. And in order to trigger this, though, that in itself is a nuclear device. I mean, it's a nuclear explosion, and it just focuses the X-rays, so once you set it off, it's gone. It's gone. It just converts a significant part of the energy into X-rays and directs it over into here. So this is a rather sophisticated weapon, because you have a nuclear device which is blowing up, but immediately before it blows up, you want to capture enough energy in the form of X-rays and focus them on this rocket that's going 16,000 miles an hour. Okay, you can see this is rather difficult. Another plan they have is to have a satellite, and if it's high enough up, it has a fixed orbit. It has to be up, around 26,000 miles. And what happens is the orbit of the satellite is the same rotation as the turning of the Earth, I say, when it's way up there. And so then as the Earth turns, the satellite turns with it. So from our perspective, the satellite is fixed in the sky. And one of the proposals, President Reagan's science advisor, is that we would have a ground-based laser, because they take a tremendous amount of energy. You might have to trigger them with a nuclear device. And you fire this laser beam up to 26,000 miles, 40,000 kilometers. It hits this mirror, bounces back over to another mirror over in here that's orbiting, and that mirror bounces the laser all the way on back. Now that's a rather sophisticated technological development. Your mirror up here would have to have, from what I've read at least, a higher degree of precision than the Mont Palomar telescope mirror. So you're talking about very sophisticated devices. And people point up, well, suppose the Soviets launch some garbage or sand into space, won't that destroy your mirrors? And the answer, as far as I can receive, is yes. So you have a rather sophisticated technological system. How sophisticated? Well, Herbert York, who worked on the Manhattan Project, gave a talk that I was at several weeks ago, and he did a calculation. I haven't checked it out. It'd be easy to check out. That if you take the speed of light, the time that it takes for a signal, any signal, this is the maximum speed you can get from any signal, laser beam, radio, or anything else. By the time you send a signal up to this mirror, down to this mirror, and back, because of the speed of light, that rocket will have already moved a half a mile. Okay, so you're talking about some rather sophisticated technology that we do not now have. Those are the proposals. Now, the argument behind those proposals is that we would like to protect ourselves from nuclear missiles. We'd like to get away from the idea of deterrence. Deterrence being, in a basic sense, you won't fire at me because you're afraid I'll fire back at you. And the other person has the same viewpoint. They're saying that that's morally, that's not a good strategy to follow because it would be much better to defend ourselves against the missiles that are here. However, the critics point out, and they ask them, are you going to give up your own missiles? And the answer to that is no, you wouldn't be giving up those missiles. And the arguments then get to be rather sophisticated, the pros and cons about this system. One of the big arguments that is made by groups such as the Union of Concerned Scientists is that it's a lot cheaper to get around the system than it is to build the system. So for every $10 that we would spend building the system, the Soviets could spend $1 getting around the system. And for example, we take the X-ray laser. Okay, the X-rays will not penetrate the atmosphere. So what they could do is just build a more rapidly burning booster that, say, took 50 seconds instead of, they said 6 minutes, but the boosters are getting faster. A more rapidly burning booster, which by the time it left the outer atmosphere, would be all ready to release all of these warheads, so you wouldn't have one target, you now have 100 targets, and only 10 of them would be warheads. So the X-ray laser cannot penetrate into the atmosphere. Besides, they say, if you can develop the X-ray laser, that will make an ideal anti-satellite weapon, if it really works. So if you have all of these, battle stations, such as they've described up there, be they X-ray or whatever, and the Soviets were to develop the X-ray laser, it actually works better against the satellites than it does against the rockets. So, if this system would work, the X-ray laser, it would work best against the defensive system. That's what the critics say. There are a number of other countermeasures that they talk about. For example, they can put a reflective covering on the missiles, very light reflective covering. And the idea is that the lasers, the light would bounce off, and you'd have to then intensify the light to burn through this protective layer, and that would cost you a tremendous amount. Or they could rotate as the rockets go up, they could rotate them so that the X-ray beam is not focused long enough on one part in order to burn a hole in it and blow it up. So those are some of the criticisms of this particular system here. I'll spend most of my time on the boost phase system, and we'll talk about the other phase in the question and answer period. However, the most serious criticisms are these. Well, if you were in the Soviet Union and you were going to go ahead and faced with this, and you knew that they were going to build these rather sophisticated systems, and you didn't have the technology to get around it, we would think, a lot of people would say, oh gee, that's good. But if you're the Soviets, what would you do? Well, one of the things you'd do is just build more rockets. Okay? And if it's cheaper for you to build more rockets than it is for us to put up systems to shoot them down, you're ahead. So the opponents of the Star Wars are saying, that's just going to continue the arms race. Some people say, oh yes, but we can build these a little bit cheaper. And then they say, oh, then that'll just force the Soviet Union to build theirs cheaper. Okay? Well, how would they build them cheaper? Well, right now the Soviet Union puts their ICBMs now in underground silos to protect them. They could, some critics say, not put them in underground silos because it would get too expensive because they'd have so many of them. So they put them above ground. But then in order to make sure that we didn't hit them, we didn't knock them out, they would put them on a launch-on warning system. What a launch-on warning system is, they have their satellites up. If they think, due to their data that's coming in, that we are launching an attack, theirs go off automatically. Okay, that's, so you're putting a big reliance on the technology and the computers. But nevertheless, the critics of this system say the Soviets might decide to do that. They might say, look, we've got to have enough weapons to overcome that system. Therefore, what we can do is just make a lot of missiles, and it'll be too expensive for them. If they make another defensive system, we just build 100 more missiles. Okay? And all it takes, you see, is a small percentage of them getting through to cause tremendous damage. You might say, well, why would the Soviet Union do that? In this system, they said, well, because the Soviet Union might launch a first strike. Well, the Soviet Union doesn't think that they would. They're afraid of us, and we're afraid of them. And I think it might be good, very important, to ask the question, how does the Soviet Union see this system? Say, if you're dealing with two sides, you have to say, how does the Soviet Union see this system? So I've got a quote from D.F. Ustino, who was the Marshal of the Soviet Union, member of the Politburo. He died just recently, but very high-ranking Soviet official. And I'll read a quote, he delivered this in a speech to in East Germany. So it's an internal quote. This is how they're talking about our own system. They say, recently the United States President announced the beginning of a development of a large-scale and highly effective anti-missile defense, the system we just described. But in fact, this would not be a defensive measure, but an offensive one. That's how they see it. Aimed at the acquisition of a first nuclear strike potential by the United States. See, the tape said we wanted to prevent them first strike. They're saying we need it so we can have first strike. Now, why would a defensive system be a first strike? He goes on. It is designed to deprive the Soviet Union of the ability to deliver a retaliatory strike and to disarm the USSR in the face of the American nuclear threat. So what they're seeing it as is this way. It's like a shield, okay? And you've got a sword. Now, if you don't have the shield, it might be kind of dangerous for you to come and use your sword. But if you've got a shield, you might be more tempted to use your sword. That's kind of how they see it. And the way they see it is this. Look, building a defensive system for our several thousand missiles over here, okay? Let's say we have 1,000 missiles. To build a defensive system, if we were to take the initiative, that's almost impossible. But if we only had, say, 100 missiles, maybe they could do it. Okay, that's how they think. Okay, let's just say, now you can see the technological point. It's easier to design a system against a disorganized 100 missiles than it is to design a defensive system against, say, 1,000 well-coordinated missiles. Do you agree with that? I mean, if you're designing the system, okay? So you got two design criteria. The first one, 100 missiles, poorly coordinated. The second one, 1,000 missiles, very well coordinated. Okay? If you're a design engineer, it's easier to defend against case one than it is against case two. Well, the Soviet Union says, when would we ever get case one? When would you only ever get, say, 100 disorganized missiles firing at the United States? When's the only condition you might get that if you're in the Soviet Union?
After a first strike.
After a first strike against them, you see? So they say, hey, I don't think they can build a defensive system if we were to actually launch a first strike against them, because there'd be 1,000 missiles, we'd have decoys, we'd have it all coordinated. But they might be able to build one against 100 and disorganized. That's the only way they can build it. That's the way their scientists tell them. So then they start saying, why are they building it? And they're also building the MX at the same time, a new missile, highly accurate. They're building the D-5, which is a highly accurate warhead for the Trident submarine. Why do they need those accurate missile warheads? Why do you think they might say it? Why do we need accurate, real accurate ones? Now, take the Soviet perspective. I'm not saying why are we doing it, but we got to put ourselves in their shoes because we want to prevent them from doing something crazy, right? Okay. Right. So we need the accurate ones so we can send our missile and hit it right on top of their silos and blow their own missiles up. Hitting a city, you don't need accuracy. Hitting even a military base, you don't need accuracy. You don't need accuracy to hit a factory. You don't need accuracy to even knock out railroads. You do need accuracy, though, to knock out other missiles. So they say to themselves, if they're building this system to prevent 100 missiles from coming back, and they're building accurate warheads, what are they up to? They begin thinking, aha, first strike. Now, you got to make a distinction here. It doesn't matter if that's what we believe we're doing. You see? If they believe it, that's what makes it dangerous. Okay? If they believe it. Because if they really believe it, and then they get afraid, and we're starting to build this, then the critics say, how do you think they might think? Okay? They might say, we can't allow them to build that. Okay? They might say that. This is what the critics in the United States say. That's how they might think. And if they're in a certain degree of internal turmoil, they get a little paranoid, they get a little trigger happy, there's a few technological mistakes, misperceptions, there could be a war. That's what the critics are arguing. Okay? So you see there's arguments on both sides. There's the argument on this side, why not defend against the warheads? There's the argument on the other side, that's just going to accelerate the arms race. Okay, that's the argument on the other side. And that is an argument in the United States, and it is an argument being held by, it's not a political argument, at least the dimensions I've been on. It's groups within the scientific community, the technological community, they are arguing. Right now, I would say the state of the argument is this. There are very, very few who think that we could defend against an attack, defend our cities. A city is a very hard thing to defend against. Okay? So the Star Wars program that President Reagan would like to have, okay, and the one he announced, there aren't very many that I've met in the scientific community that are saying that is something that we can do. They're talking now about Star Wars 2, okay, which involves more a defense of our own missile systems, okay, which politically isn't as popular. But they're making the argument that if we can defend against our own missile systems, then the Soviets will know that They cannot knock out our missiles, and if they ever try it, we'll defend against it and we'll fire back at them. It's the same, you know, mutual assured destruction that we had before. Okay? But some of them are arguing we ought to do that. Okay? Now, this argument is not new. The United States and the Soviet Union both considered building a ballistic missile defense system back in about 1970. And they formed a treaty against that. And at the time, the reason why they formed the treaty against that is because they felt it would just accelerate the arms race. That one way to get around a defensive system is simply build bigger offensive systems. So that's the way you get. And they said, look, there's no point in doing that. So they had a treaty, and the treaty said, no defensive systems, except each country can have one site. The Soviet Union picked Moscow, and they've got all these missiles around Moscow. The United States doesn't seem to think that that would be very effective. All it means is we've targeted more warheads on Moscow. That's what's happened. They have about 80 warheads, I think, targeted on Moscow, something like that. So you know, it kind of proves our point that if you get it, the one people argue it's proved the point that they built this big defensive system around Moscow. All it means is there's more targets on Moscow because so they get half of them. You know, 40 of it make it through. You only need two or three make it through. Okay, that's the argument. The United States has the option under the treaty to build one missile defense system around our missiles. The United States did not choose to build it around a city. Mainly because no city wanted it. There's no place they really wanted it. I mean, you know, it just means that more warheads are aimed there, and you've got all of these weapons around there. So the United States has not built any. Right now, both countries are cutting the corners on that treaty, and that's pretty common. There are some charges on both sides of violating the treaty. And most of the charges are political, but there are some that are significant charges that need to be pursued. One of them, a radar site in the Soviet Union, does to me, when I've heard them talk about it, appear to be a violation. But no widespread violations, blatant violations, at least from what I can see. And I just have to rely on secondary sources. I don't, you know, I just have to read the sources that are all available to you. Now. Even if this system worked, it would not defend against nuclear weapons because there are other types of delivery systems other than the ICBM, the intercontinental ballistic missile. There are shorter range missiles that might be launched from submarines. These systems might work for those, but the submarines sometimes have a flatter trajectory. And if they were right off the coast, it might only take them 12 minutes from launch to hit their target, whereas this one takes 30 minutes. So it takes you know, about half the time. So that gives you less time to go ahead and figure out what to do. There are other missiles. The cruise missile right now is essentially a small, you can fit several of them in this room, pilotless plane. Okay. And it's very sophisticated, very accurate. They're designing it so it's very difficult to pick up on radar. Right now, they would take several hours to get from the Soviet Union to the United States or back. But this ballistic missile defense system doesn't do anything for the cruise missiles. They'd have to develop some other system for that. It doesn't do anything for bombers. And now the bombers will have these cruise missiles on them, so the bombers actually don't have to fly over the Soviet Union or the United States. They have the missiles on them, they fly up there, and then they drop the missiles, and then the missiles go very close to the ground, very close to the ground, very small, very hard to pick up on the radar, and they track the land, and they're very accurate. So the ballistic missile defense system that's proposed with the lasers, that wouldn't work for the cruise missile or for the airplanes, the conventional bombers. And it would have some limited for the submarine launch. It could deal with some of the ballistic missile, submarine launch, ballistic missiles, not the cruise missiles. So you can see the controversy is not simply do we have offense or defense. there's the controversy. Let me review a little bit of the controversy. Number one, one of the controversies is, look, for every $10 we spend, they spend $1 to get around it. Okay, it's not worth it. It'll just promote the arms race. The other side responds, you're just being negative on technology. That's what they said about landing a man on the moon. And you're just being negative. We don't know how to do it, but don't be so negative. The other side then turns around, and one of the critics, Richard Garvin, says, look, landing on the moon, you're dealing with a fixed entity, the moon. It doesn't fight back. If you take the moon landing project, he says, several moon men with axes could have wiped the whole thing out. Okay? The point being that when you're dealing with an opponent that's trying to get around it, it's a lot more difficult. It's a lot more, you're not dealing with a fixed thing, the moon. The moon doesn't fight back. Okay? Or at least if it fights back, it's always constant the way it does it. Okay? It's just the natural laws that are there. So that's the one argument, the kind of it costs us more than it costs them. The other arguments are, of course, that some people, of course, argue it just won't work. Okay, it just won't work. The computer scientists are making some of the biggest arguments on this now. All of this stuff would have to have computer systems that are tremendously complex computer systems. And the computer scientists themselves are saying, hey, wait a minute, you're putting too much reliance on the computer technology. The issue about a month or two ago in Atlantic Magazine, you can read, there's a very good article in Atlantic Magazine on the computer requirements for these kinds of defensive systems. They require large, complex computer programs, and they have to work right the first time, and there's no real way to test them. Okay, now that's, if you've ever worked in sophisticated technology, you know that it never works the first time. Sometimes not the second time. So, or the third, or sometimes never. But the computer scientists are the ones that are rebelling. I'm going to spend a little bit of time tomorrow talk about the rebellion of some of the computer scientists and the implications of that, because there's some very interesting ethical problems involved when you transfer these things to computers. Okay, the other argument being that the Soviets will do something dangerous, they will be pushed to do something dangerous, such as going to a launch on warning system with more missiles, or they might simply do something that disrupts our system, like orbiting sand, and then, you know, destroying all our mirrors. Then what are we going to do? How are we going to respond? Are we going to treat that as an attack on the United States? How do we respond? No, you know, I don't think anybody's really worked through that yet. So you can see there are those kinds of arguments. There are people who are afraid that the Soviet Union, particularly in a time of crisis, will perceive this as an offensive system. And that will be a very dangerous thing to do. So that's what the critics are saying. The proponents are still saying, wait, we're just talking about research. We ought to really work this thing out. Maybe we can work it out. Maybe we can even share the technology with the Soviet Union. President Reagan said that. The critics of that say, wait a minute. I don't think that's particularly realistic in terms of sharing the technology with the Soviet Union. Certainly, if we can develop a greater trust between the two countries, that's fine. Let's do it. But to simply build a technology with a distant hope that the dangers will go away because we'll share it with them is not realistic. That's their response. So that's the debate. It goes back and forth. A lot of people, of course, are arguing that the devices themselves won't work. If the Soviet Union stayed the same for 50 years, I think most people think that, well, yeah, it might work then. But of course, the Soviet Union is not going to stay the same for 50 years. So then the question is, will it work? That's another question. So there are people saying it's too expensive. It's too easy for the Soviet Union to get around it. There's some people who are saying it's dangerous. There's some people saying it won't work. Okay. There's other people saying, yes, it will. We ought to pursue it. Generally speaking, the proponents are saying, hey, let's do the research. It's too early to talk about these things. Or to delay because of these things. The opponents are saying, once the research gets going, it's awfully hard to stop any project. And I can give you some examples of that. So that's the way the debate is. Okay, what I'll do now is I'll just kind of open it up for questions, and we can focus on Star Wars or any of the other things, if I know.
Yeah. Going on the assumption that the Soviet Union would launch whatever they have against us, do the critics of the United States Star Wars system have any proposals on what to do should that happen?
Should the Soviet Union launch a strike against us?
Yes.
There are several, you know, the official policy is that the United States would strike back. I mean, this is the official policy. Now, how they would strike back, how much they would strike back, how quickly they'd strike back, that's, you know, they keep wondering on that. But the official policy for a long time, that's the whole nature of deterrence, is if the Soviet Union were to strike us, we'd strike them back. That's why they won't do it. That's the official policy.
Yeah, because you hear a lot of criticisms against, you know, the research and against doing all these things. I'm not saying that it's good or bad. It seems that there has to be an alternative rather than saying, okay, don't shoot, we give up, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what the policy has been, is if you shoot, the basic policy is this. And there's some criticisms of this policy. I'm not saying I advocate it, but I mean, this is one of the views. One of the views is the way a nuclear war would start is that the Soviet Union, and of course the Soviet Union says the same thing about the United States. You know, you realize this, but we're in the United States, so we'll say from the United States perspective. One way a war would start, one set of assumption, is that the Soviet Union figures up all the benefits and the costs, and the benefits exceed the costs, and so they decide to do it. So the way you stop them from doing it is make sure the costs are so high that even if they make a math error, they will always come out with higher costs than benefits. And they will rationally never decide to do it. That's traditional deterrence. That's traditional deterrence. That is one set of assumptions about how a nuclear war might start. There is another group that has a different set of assumptions. Now, you know, there are different groups. When one group has a set of assumptions, they meet with all the same people who have to share that group. And then this group over here meets, and they all share each other's assumptions, and they think each other are crazy. They don't even think about the other person's assumptions. I mean, you've been in situations like that. I kind of wander between the groups so I can kind of pick up their assumptions. One of the other assumptions on how a nuclear war would start, what I call Class B assumptions, Helen Caldicott is one that has that, is that the Soviet Union gets paranoid. They get so afraid that we're going to launch an attack that they decide, look, we better do it first. Okay? We don't have any choice. Our only choice is, do we go first or second? And it's always better to go first. Okay? So that, you see what I mean. That's the second, the paranoid response. Well, you can see how these two people, once they make different assumptions, get into conflicts, even though both groups want to decrease the probability of war. If you have Class A assumptions, the more weapons you have, the higher the costs are going to be, and therefore the Soviet Union will never perceive more benefits than costs. That's Class A assumptions. Under Class B, the more weapons you have, the higher the probability is that they're going to get paranoid, think you're going to attack them, and they're going to attack you. So Helen Caldicott says, let's have less. The other group says, let's have more. They differ on their assumptions.
Okay. What's the prevailing mood?
Right now, in the administration, the Class A assumptions. That's the traditional one that the Soviet Union, and that's the theoretical one that they use the most. I think it's very narrow, that the Soviet Union will do this benefit cost. That's the basic one. Yes?
We live in a real volatile world and not in 4 technology, but you get to thinking of our history. And I think back to where, you know, we've got let's say, for example, the biggest Marine Corps in the world, equipped better than any other country. We have the biggest Air Force, technology number one. But when it comes right down to the wire, taking the example of the hostage crisis in Iran, here we have all these minds have been trained in the best military colleges. We have the equipment. We go over there and we boggle it, the sand gets in the intakes of the helicopters and the jets, and 50 people die, or whatever. And I think of those things, and then compare them to here,
yeah, that's right.
Such as right. our Marines in Lebanon, right. 300 of them dying because somebody didn't build a brick wall.
Yeah,
I mean, it gets back to the basics.
Things don't work out so nearly as clearly.
Look at this, I think. Maybe they, this looks nice, but we've got the technology, but somewhere along the line it never works.
That's right. I let me make a point on this. One of the things that we have in technology and science is that the people who receive the most status, get to the highest, are the inventors, Edward Tellers. The people in maintenance and operation are at the lowest scale. But the people in maintenance and operation are the ones that really know how the systems work and don't work, right? The innovators, the designers, as soon as it's off on the drawing board, they're off someplace else.
And if they don't get together, it's just going to be 50.
They don't. There's a big class difference. And I think if Edward Teller was the inventor of the atomic or the hydrogen bomb, if he had to work on the Mavericks for a while, his views would be very different. Because, you know, I mean, know that things don't work the way they're supposed to work. So there is a class difference between them. You're absolutely right. Yes?
How many faults?
How many what?
How many faults launchings have been stopped or shown that there was actually attack and a counterattack? I read.
How many false alerts?
Yes.
Well, it depends the different levels of false alerts that you have. You know, the really serious, there's probably been less than 10, you know, really serious ones. But there's always equipment, you know, they see the geese, a flock of geese, they think it's a flight of airplanes. And there's always the equipment that you know, those things happen. Now, in normal times, there's a lot of checks in the system, like today. There's a lot of checks in the system. And there are a lot of people who know exactly what you're saying. They say, hey, we don't expect this stuff to work. I mean, those scientists back there might. But we know better. And you know, anybody who has to work equipment is going to come to think that way. I mean, yeah, the stuff doesn't work as well. And so consequently, if they see something, the first assumption they make is, well, it's probably a mistake. And they check it out and they try things different out. And they find out the mistakes. But when we go on an alert, that's when the danger might happen. Because then they start taking out the checks so that they can make the system more responsive. And so the danger is that we might get into a state of crisis where we go on alert, and all of the common sense kind of people, finally, they have to hook their machine to the next machine rather than them checking it out, because there isn't time. They have to make this whole decision in less than 30 minutes or less than 12 minutes. Okay, so the whole thing is wired. And then what it might act, the whole system might act as a amplifier. Okay, it might develop feedbacks. Like if I take this microphone and I take it up to a speaker, what happens? Starts screeching. Okay, what happens is a small little sound gets amplified. Okay, and there are people who are arguing that if we wire this whole system up, take out all those checks, it acts like an amplifier, and a minor perturbation could get amplified to global holocaust. That's part of the new thinking that's coming along, new criticism. It's a little different. But generally speaking, we haven't had, we haven't had the alerts, a whole lot of alerts where people have really been sweating it, at least the ones I know. Yeah.
Isn't the cruise launched from Northern Canada 8 minutes to Moscow?
No, the cruise would take a lot longer than that. Right now, the 8 minute one would be the Pershing 2, and that's in based in Germany, and that is a ballistic missile. The cruise only goes about 600 miles an hour. So you can get out a map and see how long it takes, and then figure 600 miles an hour, plus maybe some curving around. Although most of them have to be launched from an airplane too, because they don't have enough range to get that far yet. So the cruise takes a longer period of time. These missiles, from what I know though, once they're launched, there's no way to stop them. They don't have a blow-up system on them. So if there was an accidental launch, there's not, and you know it's accidental, once it's going, as far as I know, there's nothing you can do about it. The cruise, you might, if you could get a fast plane to catch it, you might shoot it down. Because, you know, planes can go faster than the cruise missile. The ballistic missile, no. And if the cruise missile, you couldn't find it, no. They don't have, like, see the space systems. When we send a satellite up, if the rocket's going off, they have a destruct button you push. From what I understand, now of course this is secret, but everyone I've talked to seems to say, oh no, they don't have that. They don't have that. They're afraid the Soviets might get the code to it or something like that.
That's another interpretation from the Soviet side, is that being the first strike.
That's right.
Weapon.
That's right. So then the Soviets see that as, oh, of course they don't want to have a self-destruct, because once they launch them, they, you know, they've done it. So see, they see it from a different perspective than we do. Yes?
Each one of your defense systems here is based upon heat. Is that right?
No, the initial one would be based, with the launcher going up, on infrared sensors based on the heat. Now, once it gets up in here, there may be on heat, there could be other kinds of detection devices.
Has anybody thought about all these different satellites that we have up there that are going by constantly, and someone putting one up and saying, hey, it's a satellite, where in fact, it's in the equilibrium a couple of hundred, 250 miles up. And it is a ballistic missile, so when they get to the right place, all they got to turn it over and send it down.
They could launch satellites which are nuclear warheads, and then all they'd have to do is slow them down. They go in the atmosphere and down. Mm-hmm. Now they are proposing to have defensive systems down here, but the problem with that is they want to get the. I haven't talked about that. They want to get the boost phase. But you're right. If they start putting up nuclear weapons in space. Then the problem becomes even more severe. More severe. Yes?
I'd make two comments. I think one is, I think in this whole debate, you've got to be very careful about setting up straw men, in the sense that all technology you design doesn't work. There are many, many examples in space technology and very sophisticated industrial applications where, in fact, the technology
I don't mean all technology, but
you know, okay, I mean,
it doesn't work perfectly all the
but
time.
But we have many applications where we can show that the technology did work as designed. So I think you can get yourself into some problems saying, because it's military technology.
No, I'm not saying that.
Second thing is, I think a lot of the debate that you presented is very much a debate that's very narrow in focus, in the sense that it's a debate that's revolving around the scientific and technical community. And I think if you debate this issue, you've got to debate it also in the political spectrum, where a lot of people would take the position, yes, you may be right, that the SDI may have weaknesses in it, but the fact of the matter is, take Janies, take anybody, that the Russians so overwhelm us in missile offensive capability, in the hardness of the silos, in accuracy right now, that we are in far less than a preeminent position. And the fact that the one traces through the so-called arms agreements we've had, that the United States is in fact negotiated from a position of weakness. Therefore, what we've done is we've given away things, and the Russians have turned around and violated every agreement we've ever made with them. And that while SDI may be a bad idea, while it may be less than cost effective from a political and strategic standpoint, let's push SDI simply because of it gives us negotiating strength with the Russians, and they're worried about it.
Okay.
And a lot of people would fight that.
Okay. Let me take several of the things to respond to. If you take such a thing as throw weight of ballistic missiles, the Soviet Union is very much ahead of us. They can put up more megatonnage, more weight, throw it this way than we can throw back. They have more land-based ICBMs than we do. That is true. That is true. And you can go down a number of other categories. That is also true. Okay. Now, when it comes to the numbers of warheads, there's some debate on that. But nevertheless, it's close. It's close. Several arguments on that. Well, maybe we ought to come back on this one tomorrow. But I've never met or heard a military person say they would trade our system for theirs, because what we're doing is we're comparing quantitative, which a qualitative. And one of the reasons why the United States has lower throw weight is because we've had a more sophisticated technology. We didn't need the big, huge rockets. We particularly liquid fueled ones, which we think are archaic, which they still have, most of theirs. Okay.